Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, February 11th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Jonathan Last book, What to Expect When No One is Expecting. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. We have two experts joining us for our teleforum call today, author Jonathan Last himself and Ramesh Panuru, Senior Editor for National Review. A link to Mr. Last's book, What to Expect When No One is Expecting, was included in the notices you received for today's call and is available on the Federalist Society's website as well. Mr. Panuru will conduct a short interview of Mr. Last discussing his book and its implications, after which we're going to turn to you, the audience, for your questions. That interview is going to take about 30 minutes. In addition to his duties at National Review, Mr. Panuru is a columnist for Bloomberg View, a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he has published articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Newsday, the New York Post, and on and on. His longer bio has been provided to you in the notice of this call as well, so I'm not going to introduce him any further. Let's just turn things over to Mr. Panuru. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I am very happy to be here talking with my old friend, Jonathan Last, who's a senior writer at the Weekly Standard. And as Dean mentioned, he's written a new book about demographics, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, America's Coming Demographic Disaster. I read it over the weekend, and I can tell you it is a compulsively readable book. I would have said you can read it at one sitting, but one of the things I found now that I have kids is there are no one-sitting books anymore. But it's terrific. It's fantastically thought provoking, and so I'd like to dive right in, Jonathan, by asking you to talk a little bit about the sort of old conventional wisdom, which I guess in some quarters is still hanging on, that we have to worry a lot about overpopulation, both in this country and around the world.
Yeah, hey Ramesh, it's fun to be here. You know, we have one sitting book in my house, and that is Hands Are Not for Hitting. I don't know if you guys have had to break that out for your little angels or not. So we've been hearing about the dangers of overpopulation for a couple hundred years now, since Thomas Malthus was in short pants. And the lament is always the same. There are too many people, there are not enough resources, doom and calumny to follow. Now, the way it used to be phrased, of course, was that there are too many of the wrong kind of people, and there are not enough resources and doom and calumny to follow. That was constant all the way up through Margaret Sanger's day. The sainted head of Planned Parenthood was explicitly racist in all of her goals, including like the invention of the birth control pill. And it was present even in American sort of, Club of Rome style thought up through the 1950s and 60s when Paul Ehrlich finally came out. And Ehrlich then sort of finally shunted off basically the racist trappings of that old argument and made it purely ecological and Mother Gaia-centric. And what he said in his book, The Population Bomb, which is probably the most influential book on demographics that will ever be written, what he said was that hundreds of millions of people are going to die soon, and there is nothing we can do about it. And he was wrong. He was wrong in every particular. Hundreds of millions of people did not die, beginning in 1972. It turns out, in fact, that not only was that not happening, but at the precise moment Ehrlich was writing his book, the fertility rates in the West began falling off the table. By 1973, just about every Western industrialized country had a sub-replacement fertility rate. That is, their fertility rate went below the 2.1 mark, which is the average number of children that a woman needs to have over the course of her lifetime in order to keep the population stable. And that even more interestingly than that, is that within about 15 years, that fertility decline, which had set in the West, began spreading throughout the world. And so that today, you have 97% of the world's population living in a country where the fertility rate is in decline. You have a global fertility rate which in a generation and a half has dropped from about 6.0 to 2.5 and is still falling. And you have most projections from places like the United Nations and the World Bank, not hotbeds of conservatism or doom-mongering in this sense, projecting that we're going to peak in our population in about 60 years or so. We'll probably peak somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 billion or so, and then we're going to begin losing population on the global scale. And I would say that in all of this, you know, in all of this time, what you've seen is that the dangers of overpopulation never quite manifest. They're always out over the horizon. And in fact, a lot of attendant improvements come along with them. In fact, there are many fewer people starving today than there were in 1900, despite the fact that there are quite a lot more people on the planet. And in fact, famine and starvation in general no longer really exist, except to the point that they are used as weapons by corrupt dictators in third world countries. And all this is because of the Green Revolution in agriculture. Further, you see that in industrialized, wealthy countries, the environment has actually gotten much, much cleaner over the last 40 years or so. And that's because, you know, properly understood, environmentalism turns out to be a luxury good. It's something which you can achieve once you have, you know, success and a growing economy. And so, I'm sorry, guy, am I filibustering here, Ramesh? You want to pull me onto something else? This is the problem with being a monomaniac about these things.
So we are seeing fertility decline lots of places. You obviously think of this as something to be very concerned and worried about, and I think that maybe the sort of threshold question a lot of people are going to have encountering your book and your thesis is, why does this matter? Why is it a matter of public concern? How many kids people have? Isn't that a private matter?
Well, it is. I mean, children are both, in a classical economic sense, children are both private goods and public goods. They are private goods in all this is sort of in the same way that, you know, I would say Michael Bloomberg would make the case about drinking sodas. They are private goods in the fact that, you know, they are yours and you're the ones responsible for them. But they are public goods in the fact that society needs them, you know, without children. As Whitney Houston once sung, children are the future. And it's true. I mean, in the stupidest sense possible, you know, without kids, there is no society going forward. But so without children, you wind up with a bunch of things happening all at once, this cascade of effects. The first, when you have your fertility rate below the replacement level, is that your age profile inverts, so you wind up with many more old people than young people. This causes the sort of obvious problems that you would expect in regards to, like, the entitlement state. You know, Social Security and Medicare become unworkable, as we have seen here. You then also have downstream economic problems that result from that. As old people sort of come to predominate your society, consumption begins to dry up in every field except for healthcare. Innovation begins to lag behind because you have skinnier cohorts of people who are typically in their entrepreneurial and innovative years of between about 20 and 40 years old, which is where most of that historically has taken place. And then you have capital pool problems because in a normal age-balanced society, you have large pools of capital that are being invested for growth. Well, in an older society, old people are not looking to grow their capital. They are looking to preserve and then draw down their capital. And so anyway, you wind up with a sort of stagnant economies, which you've seen historically, and in fact are seeing in places like Japan today. Japan is the leading edge of all this, and they have been in what we first thought was a lost decade of the 1990s, but now we're in sort of year 23 of recession in Japan, and is generally looked at as this is the classic case of demographic winter.
So why are we seeing this decline in so many different societies?
And I guess
in particular in our own.
Yeah, and this is the $64,000 question. There are a bunch of universal causes, you know, the most obvious of which is the decline in infant mortality rate. This is a good thing. We're not lamenting this. But as, you know, as this, you get increases in sanitation and medicine and food, you know, children are able to survive longer. That's very good. Increases in education. You can go back 200 years and see an education effect in terms of dampening fertility. And as education becomes more prevalent around the world, fertility gets dampened. This, too, is probably, you know, on net a very good thing. But then you have particular concerns. In Russia, for instance, they have an enormous problem with alcoholism, such so that if you look at Russia's public health indicators right now, they look like a third world country. You know, they look like Chad or Afghanistan. In Japan, their problem is largely a problem of the marriage culture. People are sort of abandoning marriage altogether. And because in Japan, out-of-wedlock birth is still very much considered to be a no-no. This means people just don't have kids at all. And in America, there are, you know, this is, of course, where I spend most of my time talking, and it's a really complicated question. I call it a giant constellation of forces. You know, don't call it a conspiracy, but sort of all nudging people in the same direction. Some of these forces are cultural. Some of these forces are economic. But it's a big picture, and I think sort of understanding a way out of it requires understanding, in some broad sense, basically kind of how we got here.
My understanding, and you're just the man to correct me if I'm wrong, is that in a lot of poor countries, it remains the case that people's ideal family size is smaller than the actual family sizes they end up with. But in this country, it seems to be a gap in the other direction, where actual sizes of families are smaller than ideal sizes. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit about what that means and why.
Sure. So ideal for same family sizes is, you know, demographers measure what they call the ideal fertility rate, and that is when you ask people, how many kids would you like to have in a perfect world, they tell you. Now, it is interesting that in some poor countries, the ideal number is lower than actual, which shows that people are having more kids than they intend to. But those gaps across the world are actually shrinking. And a new gap has arisen in Europe. In Germany and Belgium and Austria and a couple other countries now, you have gaps in the other direction, where even in rich countries, people's ideal rate is now falling and is below the replacement rate. So people don't even, in theory, for instance, in Austria, where the ideal fertility rate is, I think, 1.7, even in theory, they don't want to have kids. Which brings us then to America. And this is, I think, maybe the most interesting thing I found. If you look at American culture over the last 40 years, you would guess that our concept of what the ideal fertility rate is would probably have changed quite a bit. You would think that large numbers of people, for all sorts of reasons, have decided they don't want family life, they don't want children, and they would like to focus on other things, focus on themselves, focus on their careers. This is certainly the narrative that we've been fed, but the numbers tell a very different story. The average fertility rate in America right now is 2.5. That's interesting because it is high above our actual fertility rate, which is 1.9. But the most interesting thing about that is that that 2.5 number has been constant for 40 years now, which shows that despite all the sort of things you might read in the Atlantic Monthly or the New Yorker, and I don't want to sort of take away the – I don't want to invalidate the experiences of somebody who writes for the Atlantic or who writes for Slate who says they don't want kids. I say God bless them and I celebrate their choice. But that's not the median experience in America. The average person in America wants 2.5 kids, and the gap then that exists – is between the families we want to have and the families we are actually able to achieve.
Right, which I suppose could have any number of causes, not finding, you know, what you consider the right person or finding that person too late, that sort of thing.
Right, or just simple economics. It's,
right.
When you tally up all the costs and you count, child care, college costs, lost parental wages, it runs about $1.1 million to raise a kid. Just in normal America, that's if you're in Ohio. You know, if you're in New York or someplace else, it costs a lot more. And, you know, like what I say in the book is, you know, $1.1 million, let's put that in perspective, the median house price in America is $185,000. So that's like buying five kids all at once. I think that's asking a lot of people.
Now, speaking of economics, you talk about something which I myself have written a fair amount about over the years, which is the effect of Social Security and Medicare on the number of kids people have, which is something I think is not widely understood. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, you're smarter than I am on that stuff and many other things, and so you should feel free to jump in and talk about this when I start sounding dumb. But there are two effects of this. I mean, the first is just the sort of naked tax burden. Social Security takes a much larger bite out of people's paychecks than it did when the program was first conceived. And that's because it was conceived in an era of high fertility when people had lots of kids, and the founders sort of never would have occurred to them that at some point the average American wouldn't be even replacing themselves in terms of adding new taxpayers to the system. But the other part of that then is the moral hazard that it creates. You know, what Social Security is it is a competing set of benefits to something which for two or three millennium had been provided solely by grown children. You know, you had five or six or seven kids, and you hoped that one of them was okay and loved you enough to take care of you once you got old and started drooling. And so Social Security, which, I would say I don't cast any aspersions on the ideas behind it. It's certainly a noble idea and has had many good effects. But what it does is it says it places the government in that role, and it says, we'll take care of you whether or not you had kids. And more to the point, that you are going to get the same benefits and pay the same things into the system whether or not you go to the expense of creating new taxpayers. Now, there has been some research on this in the last 5 or 6 years. There have been a couple good studies that come out trying to isolate the effect of Social Security and Medicare on fertility, and they suggest that it might be as much as about 0.5 kids. I mean, that's like half a kid. Now, I always, you know, when I talk to people about this, and you know this, but I would say to our honored listeners, to observe these things is not to say that you want to kill Social Security and get rid of it. You know, doing so at this stage certainly would probably have as many bad unintended consequences as it would good ones. But just to understand that, you know, these things have effects, and if we're going to figure out a way out of this, we need to be able to, you know, talk honestly and openly about them.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm going to take up your invitation to jump in a little bit, that it does strike me that we talk a lot about the effects of Social Security and Medicare on our fiscal solvency and on labor supply in the sort of short-run sense and on the capital stock, but this is an effect that, you know, we have to include in our discussions. That I guess one way of putting it is that the sort of generational, the economic transaction of the generations has been sort of collectivized here. That, you know, each generation is always going to depend on the next one to take care of it in old age. But when that is a collective dependence as opposed to an individual by individual dependence, you create a kind of free rider problem. But I wanted to also ask you about something else related to old age, because you mentioned at one point in the book that the surveys are pretty clear that when you look at it carefully, having kids is a bad thing for happiness. That similarly situated couples that have kids will report lower levels of happiness than those without. And I was just wondering whether those studies take into account the how people feel when they're older. Do people who are, you know, in their 60s and 70s who had kids feel happier than ones who did not?
Okay, so here's what happens. I'll sort of back all this up and start from the beginning so that I can then get to your question. So a lot of research over the last 40, 50 years has been done on parental happiness, and would suggest that you take two people with, you know, identical demographic markers. The people who are parents are going to be about 6 percentage points less happy than the non-parents. That's for the first child. You lose another 2 percentage points or so for each additional bundle of joy. Now, that is sort of interesting in its own and is persistent through much of adulthood. However, you then see two things happen towards old age. So by your late 50s to early 60s then, you see some rising happiness levels from the parents, and you see some declining happiness levels from the non-parents, to the point where the two almost reconverge, not quite. The non-parents are still slightly happier, but I would say to a level which is probably worth us ignoring. And so what happens here is two things, one of which is your parents are, you know, happier when they're not actually parenting, which I think in a weird way only reinforces the point about how miserable kids make you. But the other thing that's interesting is that you wind up with something like window shopper's remorse from the people who thought about having kids but didn't quite do it. And as they sort of, you know, reach the, you know, closing in towards the end of the line with a train about to pull into the station, they then begin to idealize and regret a little bit the children that they did not have.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I guess that would explain the those results. You also talk a little bit. Actually, there are a couple places in your book where it struck me that you emphasize sort of one. You emphasize the relationship between two things, where the causal direction seems to me you could reverse it very easily. So, for example, you talk about child seat laws and how we've made it much harder for people to pack large families into cars, and that this has been in some sort of unquantifiable way something that has reduced family sizes. But I wonder if it isn't also partly the other way around. That is, as family sizes have gotten smaller, that each individual child is seen as something sort of even more precious, and that risks that were formerly tolerable have become intolerable, and that then motivates things like these ever more stringent child safety laws.
You know, that's a very valid point. And in fact, there's a lot of stuff that's been written about this, although I haven't seen any research quantifying it, about the tolerance of low fertility societies for military casualties. And people have sort of, you know, the argument is made, and again, I haven't seen data on this, so I can't speak to whether or not it is true or not, although it sounds reasonable enough, that, you know, once you wind up in a society where you have, on average, one, maybe two kids, people's tolerance for military casualties is going to significantly decline. I would say in America, we certainly have seen that to be true. We have had decreasing fertility, smaller families, and our tolerance for military casualties, I think, societally has fallen. But I don't know that there's any sort of real, you know, statistically demonstrable link between the two. You know, on the specific specific case of car seats, though, I think we can safely say that the causality does not run in that direction, and that's because car seat laws are this sort of fascinating little microcosm for like how the American system works in terms of legislation. It was a crusade that nobody in the world cared about except for two guys in Tennessee. And this is a sort of classic squeaky wheel problem where there was no real constituency to push back against them. They were desperate to have car seat law. And once the car seat law passed in Tennessee, over the objections, of course, of legislators in Tennessee who made the exact case that I was making, which is that, you know, you're doing this, you're creating a tax on people with, you know, five or six kids, you know, down the road when the car seat laws are expanded. And the two guys passing it said, no, they'll never expand the laws. Don't worry. The regime will stay just as it is when we pass it. And so these guys, you know, passed their little noticed law in Tennessee, and then within, I think it's 5 or 6 years, every state in the union has it. But once the law is passed, then, of course, it spreads to the bureaucracies. And so these things are just sort of, you know, so the bureaucrats are the ones who then begin expanding the zone of protection for children in cars and, you know, make it so that even, you know, some 12-year-olds have to be in booster seats in the back of the car and all this. And so I really don't think that is a sort of societal expression of any sort as much as just an example of how in the American system, you know, if there's not a real constituency to push back against something with a very small constituency, people can move the levers of government and change the culture all by themselves.
Now, you say throughout this book that you are not trying to argue that people should have more kids, and you're not making any criticisms of people who choose to not have kids or to just have one. And yet you also keep talking about modern culture as being shallow, and the shallowness of modern culture is you know, inextricable from these trends of declining fertility. Well, that certainly sounds like a criticism to me.
Well, you know, it is, but it's not. I think it is a criticism, not in the way perhaps that it sounds. You know, so Ross Douthat had gotten all sorts of hot water for saying that all of this stuff is a result of cultural decadence a couple months back. And I think actually that Ross is onto something, and I think that there is a great deal of you could support that statement pretty easily, I think, although you could also quibble with it. But I would say two things. I really don't. I mean this totally sincerely. Anybody who doesn't want kids, I would say many people in my own family will never have children, and I love them, and they're lovely people too, and I celebrate their choices. The problem isn't sort of a question of decadence in people, you know, being selfish for themselves. What I would sort of argue the deeper philosophical problem is people prizing the present over both the past and the future. And that is not a sort of, I would say that's a different kind of decadence. That is not necessarily decadence of people who are wedded to mere happiness and mere fun, it is a sort of totally different worldview. You know, a lot of people who wind up not having kids are people who are incredibly ambitious and people who delay gratification in all sorts of ways because they want to go to an elite college, they want to go to law school or medical school or something like that, and they're constantly pushing themselves and denying themselves in order to achieve something and make something of their lives. I would say I don't think you can fairly call that decadence. It's something different. And what I think it sort of is getting at is people who are, again, prizing the present and their own existence and the sort of, you know, the now-ness of it above the idea of a future beyond themselves. And I think that that is actually one of the reasons that you see a real difference in fertility between people who go to church and people who don't go to church. One of the big fertility differentials is between is by church attendance. So you look at people who never go to church versus go twice a year versus once a month versus once a week. And the answer is that the people who go once a week, and it does not matter what their religion is, they Mormon, Catholic, Jew, Protestant, they have the highest fertility in the country. Their rate is about 2.35, well over replacement rate. And what I argue is that, you know, what they're getting at church is not be fruitful and multiply. I don't think that that is what is, you know, influencing their decisions. I think that what they're getting at whatever church they go to is the root of deism. And the root of deism is that there is something bigger and more consequential and more lasting out there than me and my life, and that what I do here is important, and important in many ways, but that it is not all there is, and there's something more.
So what we're getting is consolation for the misery that our children are inflicting on us.
Basically.
You know, actually, Mary Eberstadt has written sort of interestingly on this, again, sort of suggesting that the causal direction here might run the other way. Her theory is that, you know, Europe's loss of faith isn't just the cause of its declining, a cause of its declining fertility, but in an important way, the declining fertility is a cause of the loss of faith. That is, you know, one of the main reasons people go to church is because they've got kids. And, you know, we've all seen in our own lives people who start going to church once they start having families. And that once that stopped happening as much is when the pews started to empty.
You're making me look stupid. I got her Galleys for Mary's book literally on Friday, and it's sitting on my desk right now, in fact, mocking me, and you clearly have read part of it, and I have not, so I can't add intelligently to that.
No problem. Well, how about we talk a little bit before we open up for questions about whether, you know, look, if you're somebody who has sort of bought the argument so far as we've talked about it, that there is this major fertility decline, obviously, and that it's problematic, is there anything that can be done about it? I mean, certainly, you go through some of the evidence where a lot of countries have tried to reverse a fertility decline and failed.
Yeah, and this is where it gets a little bit depressing. So there have been, you know, there are basically two schools of natalist thought, which I sort of reductively and stupidly just reduced to the conservative school and the liberal school. And the liberal school is what, you know, like the bloggers at Slate want. They want universal daycare paid for by the government so that, you know, 95% of the female population can be in the workforce. And then there's the conservative school, which I will sort of, again, reductively and somewhat unfairly reduce to. We need to rely on economic incentives and return to traditional values and mores. And to the extent that the governments have pursued both of these paths in places like Sweden and Norway and France on the one hand, and places like Singapore and Japan on the other, the results have been very, very mixed at best. There are no real positive successes. There's a lot of analysis that's been done on these attempts. And, you know, the one survey that I point to, because it's a survey, sort of, you know, it's a poll of polls, like the Real Clear average, it looks at it and it shows that for every 25% increase in natalist policy spending, you get about a 0.5% increase in the short term infertility rates. And then you get, in the long term, after 20 years or so, your increase inches all the way up to 4%. So it's not a great return on investment. Government, it turns out, shockingly, is not very good at, you know, consciously getting people to have babies. What I propose is really much more modest. What I say is, you know, look, if we want to pursue pronatalist policies on their own merits because we think that they are rightful expressions of our society's values, that's fine and we should do it. You know, if we decide that we want national daycare centers, then that's fine and we should do it. But we should do it with our eyes open, and we should not expect that this is the silver bullet which is going to save us. More to the point, what I suggest is that we, as we think about these things, we think about just, again, reducing that disconnect, trying to find ways to sort of, you know, throw bank shots and, you know, thinking about the whatever sort of unintended roadblocks that the country and the government has raised to people achieving their ideal fertility size. We look to knock down those barriers, not to convince people who don't want kids to have them, but to try to make it easier for the people who want children to achieve the family size that they clearly want.
So to sort of cut that gap between actual and ideal family size,
right,
in this country.
Right, and that's, and I think that is, you know, to the extent that we're going to try to change anything, that's the way to do it. And that you then allow the people who are having families to sort of engage the wider culture, stepping back to the really 35,000 level foot level, let them engage the culture with their own lives. And I know whether or not the government even can or, you know, can do the or should do those things, I don't think the government has proved, any government has proved very effective at doing it.
Well, with that, let's open it up to questions. Dean?
Thank you, Ramesh. In a moment, everyone will hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold for that. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. While we're waiting for our audience to ring in here, let me make our programming announcement. Obviously, today we're discussing, if you've tuned in late, Jonathan Last's book, What to Expect When No One is Expecting. We've got a pretty good schedule for the rest of the week to round out your week. Tomorrow, we're going to be discussing the Supreme Court's Georgia-Pacific case, which was argued earlier this term, and it concerns the amount of judicial deference to the EPA, and that's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number, Eastern Time. On Thursday, we're going to be discussing a dispute between the city of Tombstone, Arizona, and the National Park System. The city's trying to get access to national park lands over which its water supply lines cross, and those lines have been damaged and are in need of repair. That is Thursday at noon, and then on Friday at 1 p.m., we're going to discuss the Second Circuit's Bronx household litigation. That's a case in the Second Circuit involving the after-hours use of school facilities by religious organizations. That's Friday at 1 p.m. Again, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button. Ramesh, it looks like we've got two questions at this point. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. We seem to have an unusual topic today in that, unlike our other forum topics, there doesn't seem to be a judicial issue as far as the eye can see. But let's just examine for a minute the, let's say, long-term legislative issues that might arise from this. As you've pointed out, no method has been found to reverse population decline once it's set in. But at what point might it become appropriate or necessary to intervene to prevent, let's say, the collapse of civilization altogether? And I've done a lot of work in computer simulation modeling of this and related issues. And I find that only about no more than about 50 million human beings are needed to sustain modern industrial civilization for the entire world. And anything beyond that, just to maintain what we would consider a rich, vibrant economy and culture and so forth, is superfluous. And that's therefore, until the decline threatens to fall below the minimum level of sustainability, we probably shouldn't be too alarmed. We have seen other societies where there's been a severe drop in the supply of younger people. We've seen entire sections of East Africa, for example, where because of AIDS, no one is left alive between the age of 16 and 60. We've seen, you know, major wars and famines and so forth. And the old people generally manage to get by taking care of one another. So People will adjust.
That's a great question. If you don't mind, I'd like to get Jonathan's answer to it. But I'll just note in my self-appointed role here as book salesman that there is actually a little bit of a discussion of Griggs versus Duke Power in the book, and it has had a kind of odd and sort of counterintuitive effect on some of the things we're talking about. But Jonathan, what's your response to that? That most of us are just gravy when it comes to civilization.
Well, boy, you have to have an awful lot of faith in your computer model to just let everything fall apart and hope that 50 million is enough. Look, if you look at the work of Esther Bozrips and Julian Simon, what they suggest is that growing populations lead to increasing technical innovation, and increasing technical innovation then solves lots of problems. It creates better agriculture, it creates disease problems, it helps with conservation of resources and supplies. All of that has been pretty well borne out. As we sort of touched briefly on in the beginning, all the Malthusian worrying has wound up being wrong over the last 200 years. I mean, the human condition keeps improving, despite the fact that we're told it should not be. And look, is 50 million people enough? I don't know. I suppose it's possible. Anything's possible. But the question is, if what you want to do is keep improving and not just sort of, maintaining some minimal subsistence level, then you would like to have more people. And besides, when things fall apart, they don't fall apart cleanly all the time. This is, my buddy, the demographer at American Enterprise Institute, Nick Eberstadt, he is reasonably sublime about all of this stuff. And the point he makes, and it's a very valid one, is that in the long, long run, we'll all be okay, because in the long, long run, the fertility rates are not constant across populations. And so whoever is breeding will inherit the earth. And he's not wrong about that. But the question is what happens in the medium run. And if what happens in the medium run is sufficiently bad, because, for instance, 300 million elderly people in China are basically put out to pasture to freeze and die because the Chinese government can't afford to take care of them, if it involves, massive collapse of the financial markets or, any of the other bad things, which I would say are all possible, they're all sort of on the table when you look around at the historical effects of population decline, then the question becomes, well, okay, so what's going to be left for the people to inherit whenever they do inherit it? And I think that, all things being equal, we would like to have a conversation about this now and think through these things now rather than, just try to sort of trust that everything will be fine and this time will be different.
It does strike me, Jonathan, that in a way it matters much more whether the population is growing or shrinking than what it happens to be at any particular point, that it's that direction that determines a lot about the social dynamics we're concerned about.
Right, and because it's always, remember, I mean, the top line number is important, but it's not as important as the trajectories, the DXDT of these slopes. And that's because the trajectory is determining not only whether or not the population is growing or shrinking, but it's determining the age shape, the contours of the age balance within your society, and that winds up mattering at least as much as anything else.
Ramesh, this is Dean Reuter. We've got four questions now. Should we go to the next caller?
Sure.
All righty.
Good afternoon. My name is John Amirati. Ramesh, I've always been fascinated with your insight into population and Social Security, especially your suggestions about increasing tax deductions for children to justify that. Jonathan's book just really puts this in context. Would either of you speculate on a moral or ethical imperative, therefore, for, say, upper-class childless individuals to leave their Social Security checks on the table, to refuse to take them because they have not really contributed into the generation of it? I'm not suggesting legislation that would certainly bring down the House, but is there a moral imperative there for people in that situation to do that?
If you don't mind, Jonathan, I'll start on this one.
I was going to ask you to, so I'm glad you're here.
It would not be the most productive argument to make. I don't think that anybody's going to actually relinquish these benefits because of such an argument. And I also think actually, people are contributing, right? I mean, paying the payroll taxes is a contribution to to these programs. The problem, I think, the, at least the way I've conceptualized it, is that parents are paying twice, that they pay extra because they're both contributing through payroll taxes and contributing through the financial sacrifices they make to have children. And the thing that, you know, I've never really come at this question from exactly the same place as Jonathan, in that I haven't been thinking we've got a declining birth rate and that's a problem, we need a policy that will address that, so much as it just strikes me as an unfairness to parents, number one, and number two, a kind of government policy that is suppressing birth rates through the mechanisms that we talked about, and therefore the government should sort of offset its sort of inadvertent tax on parents and thereby sort of probably kind of indirectly cause birth rates to go up a little bit. Jonathan, you got anything you want to add to that, or should we go on to the next one?
I was going
to
say, I will not have anything smarter than that to say.
All right, we still have somehow magically four questions left, so let's go to the next caller.
Hello, Rebecca Shapiro in San Francisco. And I'm just interested in the methodology. I know that the federal government puts out numbers every year about how much it costs to raise a child in the United States, and it's about $250,000. And I think I heard that the number is closer to $1.1 million, and obviously that's a big methodology gap, and I'm wondering if someone can flesh that out for me.
Sure thing. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ramesh.
Yeah, this one's definitely Jonathan.
Yeah, so what the government, so this is, these are the numbers that you're talking about are put out by the USDA. The guy who runs that program is named Mark Leno. He's a great guy, and he's been there for, I don't want to impugn him, but I want to say something like 50 years. And the USDA numbers are reasonably limited, actually. They don't take into account everything. They only take into account some staples. They take into account health care through 18, clothing through 18, some education, food, sort of basic shelter, stuff like that. So the bigger numbers you get then, and the real big drivers of it become once you add college costs, and you just sort of pick the median college tuition bill for, you know, either a private or public university, and then foregone parental wages or child care, because you got to pick one or the other. And, you know, the 1.1 million figure comes when you figure in, again, just an average college tuition, not someone going to Yale, and then with a parent staying home with the kid until the kid reaches school age, and then returning to work part-time until the kid reaches, I think it's middle school, and then goes to full-time after that, which assumes then that the parent can always get work whenever he or she wants to, and assumes that, again, these are median salary. These are people making about $40,000 a year, which is the median salary.
Thank you.
Next question.
All right, still four questions left.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. My name is Sunny. I'm a law student at Liberty University. And my question is specifically on abortion. If you know, based on the number of abortions that happen every year, and since especially Roe versus Wade, what effect has abortion had on the declining birth rate? And if abortion were unlawful, you know, based on the numbers of abortions that happen every year, would that fix the replacement rate, at least in the United States? Thank you.
Let me jump in on that one, just because Jonathan talks a little bit about this in the book, and I was not completely satisfied by the discussion on this point. The thing that strikes me is that although obviously to some degree, right, I mean, if you have abortion in society, some of those that represents some kids that would have been born in the absence of abortion. But I remember seeing a statistic or some sort of study that suggested that when Roe v. Wade came down in 1973, that the conception rate rose 30% and the birth rate only dropped about 6%. And that, to a large degree, a lot of the abortions represented embryos that would not have been conceived in the absence of liberal abortion laws. And I think that's an effect that we have to keep in mind when we speculate about what the effects of different abortion policy regimes would be. But Jonathan, what do you have to say on that?
I would say, boy, Sonny, do I have a book for you. It's called The Party of Death by Ramesh Punuru. And I think it's actually one of the most important books of the last 10 years. And I've actually written this. So I am not just blowing smoke because Ramesh and I are here together. It's really, really great. And if you're going to sort of understand sort of abortion in America, I don't think you can really begin to fully grasp it until you've read Ramesh's book. So that's the first point. The second point is, so we're now at 54 million abortions post-Roe. The study that I sort of mention in the book is a RAND Corporation study which looks at the effect abortion has had on the fertility rate. And what it finds is that the rate varies by race. And so for white America, Roe has actually lowered the fertility rate by very, very small amount, about 4%. And for blacks, it's measured it by a much more robust measure, a much more robust degree, 13%. Now, that there's a study, there's the numbers. Whether or not we believe them is up to us. I'm not sure. With Ramesh, I'm not sure that I do. And that's because particularly in the first decade post-Roe, you have once you have a full count of all abortions because they're legal, in that decade post-Roe, then you wind up with something like a 100% increase in the total number of abortions annually. And I have to believe, because at least in that initial decade, that a lot of those abortions probably would not have happened. Absent Roe, they would have been converted to births. Whereas after that, sort of more recently, the effect seems to be that abortion has become sort of birth control as last resort. And so I would buy the fact that more recently the effect has been less, but that in the initial period the effect was more. I don't know. Does that sound reasonable to you, Ramesh?
That sounds very reasonable. So we've reached a consensus. And we should go on to the next question.
Gentlemen, we've got about 13 minutes left and three questions at this point, just to bring you up to date.
Great.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society, and I wanted to pose three questions very briefly. First of all, I arrived late at the discussion, and so if you stop me if you heard this one. Is there, Jonathan, in your view, a correlation at all between birth rates, which are only one aspect of human family life, and what appears to be a decay in the number of intact families and sort of the existence of extended families, cousins, aunts, uncles, people dropping by to see each other, that sort of thing. In other words, is the birth rate a one part of a phenomenon that is different, which is kind of the breakdown of larger family relationships as a whole through the prevalence of divorce and abortions already been mentioned. So that was my first question. Are there two trend lines that sort of move in the same direction or move in the opposite direction? The second question that I was going to ask was, in terms of economics and wealth and birth rates, do you think that savings or earnings or the wealth society in general is most influential when people make the decision or have the decision thrust upon them that they are going to have children? I would hazard a guess that it is that people have the confidence to have families if they have some net worth, if they have some savings, and sort of in another sense, if people care enough to save, that is to say their view of the future involves that, that this same emotional view of the future may involve having families. The third, and I'm sorry if I've gone on too long, has to do with, I guess, the baby boom generation, which is kind of a textbook example, where it appeared to me, at least, I'm being a member of the baby boom generation, I guess that qualifies me to chat about it, that people decided to have children, at least in part, because of the cultural, political atmosphere of the times, the post-World War II hopes, post-World War exposure to really ultimate questions in which many, many homes either had wounded veterans or had lost people in wars, in the war, I guess, and that perhaps the phenomenon, good or bad, of this tidal wave of children in the 40s and 50s was triggered not so much by economics directly, although the United States was very wealthy after World War II, but was also triggered by a kind of euphoria, which had nothing to do with money. It was, you could almost say that it was like the Dutch tulip craze. So,
those,
you know,
those are terrific questions.
Those are sort of the three that I wanted to touch on, and I'll get off the phone or stop talking anyway, and listen to your answer.
Those are great questions. Jonathan, why don't you take a crack at them?
I took notes, Jim, so don't worry. So first question about the correlation between birth rate and intact families, and the answer is yes, there is. And the two big developments over the last 40 years or so on this have been divorce, and this is a legal question. You know, we have much liberalized divorce laws, which were done not sort of as a conscious thing, but just lawyers in California decided they want to tidy up the statutes, many of which had been on the books for, you know, literally 100 years. So that, what was the old legal joke? In New York, there were only two grounds for divorce, adultery and perjury. And so the creation of no-fault divorce was not done basically as a political statement or a cultural statement, but merely to sort of tie up some legal niceties. And so once we had widespread divorce and then cohabitation, both of these things have shown measurable effects in pushing the fertility rate down. Second is a question about the economics of wealth, you know, and how much that earnings are influence decisions. You know, in weird ways, they do, but they show up in non-consistent ways. If you look at a very detailed chart of the birth rate going with the business cycle, you have seen prior to this last recession that in some earlier recessions in the 70s and 80s, you had micro upticks in the fertility rate as we went into recessions. And that's because the opportunity costs for one of the parents, I think, you know, a parent who had gone out of work, suddenly shrunk during the course of the recession. It's counterintuitive. You wouldn't expect it to be that way. But for this last recession, beginning in 2007, the opposite has happened. And in fact, the birth and fertility rates significantly declined, and more to the point, declined at a faster rate than their previous decline before the recession had set in. So something is clearly going on with that. And the third question is about the baby boom in economics. I would suggest, and this is not based on research and numbers and data, that what was going on in the baby boom was not about a euphoria. And the reason I would suggest that is because it lasted for 20 years. The really interesting thing about the baby boom wasn't just that it was the first major spike in fertility in America since 1800. The really interesting thing about it is that it lasted for 20 years. That's a really long time. The thinking on the baby boom, the sort of the two root causes behind it, are that following the war, you had this unique moment where suddenly middle-class life in America was exploding and advancing in a runaway manner. Incomes were shooting up. Employment was running full. We were building cheap, affordable, single-family homes, because it turns out the housing structure influences your fertility as well. We were building cheap, affordable, single-family homes all across the country. And that all of this economic boom was taking place at a moment where all of the old cultural mores about the importance of getting married, the link between sex and marriage, and then the link, finally, between marriage and parenthood, all of those things still held in ways which by 1975 they didn't really. By 1975, that iron triangle had been broken by a combination of divorce, cohabitation, contraception and abortion, and then an acceptance of, you know, illegitimacy. And so before then, you know, during the baby boom, we still believed in all of those old things in deep and important ways, and that this is what contributed to the longevity of that period.
I'll just pipe up here, just one little thing, my little corner of this forest, not that I'm suggesting it's the most important part, just the part that I happen to know. When people are talking about the link between the decline in fertility and the decline in the intact family, the evidence on Social Security and Medicare and entitlement programs around the country, around the world for seniors, is that they not only reduce the fertility rate, but also reduce the marriage rate, increase the age of first marriage. Because if you're seeing yourself having fewer kids, because of, you know, for all the reasons why you'd expect that to happen under an expansive old age program, then that's a little bit less of a reason to get married in the first place. And at the same time, it's a little bit less of a reason if you're going to be taking care of an old age to want to have a sort of economic partner in life. And so I think that it affects marriage rates and fertility rates at the same time. A lot of interrelated ways.
Gentlemen, we've got two questions pending in about 4 minutes, so I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible with their questions.
Hi, Joe Crosby, attorney in Washington, and I'm wondering the degree to which cultural changes and philosophical changes over more than 100 years have affected this question, particularly the question about what constitutes happiness. Because at one point, right now, it seems to me that modern society is given to the belief that happiness is a form of pleasure. In the past, classically, it was considered, the question was, what is it that is the good, is a life well lived? And so you'd measure it not in terms of whether you were avoiding pain and increasing pleasure, but in terms of whether you were living a contented life that was worth living. And I wondered the degree to which that would, if you held to that belief, that would tend to incline you to have children in the first place. Number one. And number two, when you're taking a look at surveys of people, if the cultural norm is that happiness is a matter of pleasure, that might help to explain why people who do not have children report that they are happier, while people who do have children do not, and report that they're not as happy. And so that would lead me to wonder whether or not this is a very significant cultural issue. That might also be tied up in that sense and in that way with religious practice.
Jonathan, I think that's a good closing question for you.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, a truly great question, Joe. And this is, I've actually wound up finding myself in this discussion with people over the last couple of weeks about this stuff. And it's absolutely true that our definition of happiness has changed in a fundamental and important way. When the framers were writing, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they did not mean happiness in the way that we think of it today. They meant it in more the classical, you talked about this, the Aristotelian sense about sort of is human flourishing. And human flourishing means deeper and more important things than mere pleasure. And I think that what you said is actually true, that we have shifted in our expectations and our definition for happiness in ways which I think are probably unhealthy. And that's why, actually, ultimately, I'm a little bit pessimistic about our capacity for overcoming these things in the future, because that is something that I just don't have any idea how we change. I don't know how you return to a more sophisticated and more all-encompassing view of what the human experience should be.
Well, what a gloomy note to end on, but
I'm sorry, Ramesh.
But if there is any hope for us, it's that people might read Jonathan's book. How's that?
Well, this is Dean Reuter. I am equally hopeful of that. And the book is available at Amazon.com, What to Expect When No One is Expecting, Jonathan Last. I want to thank you and Ramesh Panur, our guest moderator and interviewer. Thank you very much for joining us today as well. To our audience, I invite you to join us for our Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, when we'll be discussing the Georgia Pacific case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.